Hello. Slava Ukraini.
Hello, I'm Slava. How are you doing today?
It is a very weird situation where I don't even understand how long we can continue with our spaces live broadcasts, considering what is happening to Twitter. So it's utterly bizarre because you know our Twitter spaces is an important way to connect to our audience and amplify Ukrainian voices. Although of course there's lots of audience coming to recorded podcasts as well.
Yeah, I know it's been a weird week in the world of Twitter, but yeah, as we say, it's important for us to have the space to talk to each other and to amplify Ukrainian voices, which is why we started doing this from the very beginning. So we'll see what happens. But
I want to remind everyone else that Ukrainian Spaces also exists on other platforms. So if you one of those people who consider to leave or you're disengaged with Twitter, you can also find Ukrainian Spaces on Instagram. Now on, I think, 8 podcast platforms. Although I have to be honest, I have a bit of frustration over people who are just, you know, flaunting in my face this privilege that they just can quit a platform and go somewhere else, where in fact the majority of Ukrainians do not have the same privilege, and we cannot quit the platform. We're already overstretched with so many because we need to amplify our voices every day and remind about genocide that is keep happening anywhere where it's possible. So I cannot just quit the platform where I have the biggest audience just because I don't feel the vibe of new owner or whatnot. This is just utterly ridiculous assumption for me.
And also, like, yeah, if, you know, sorry, this is going back to, like, life of campaigning. If an authoritarian takes over a country, we don't necessarily quit it. We need to try and change it and hold them to account. So that's what we need to do with Twitter as well. So let's see what happens. Yeah, I think important message is that we don't want to give up and we want to keep making sure that this platform is safe for people to use, because it's become something that is more than just, you know, someone's property, I guess. It's become something that a lot of us depend on for many different things that some people don't even realize we depend on. So, yeah.
Yep.
Let's be positive about it. Hopefully everything will calm down. But just quickly to remind everyone before we jump into our interview that, as always, a reminder for why we're here. We Maxim and I started this, I don't even remember how many months ago, to essentially elevate Ukrainian voices, because we saw that a lot of conversations about Ukraine were being led by non-Ukrainians, by the usual Russia experts and pundits and so on. And so we decided that it was important to create a safe space for Ukrainians to freely express themselves and talk to each other, and also try and educate the rest of the world about things through our eyes, I guess, through our views, through our history. So that's why we're here today. And before I pass to Maxim to introduce our guest for today, just wanted to remind everyone, as usual, that we are a volunteer initiative and we depend on our patrons. We have so many of you now. We're super, super grateful. We're able to do more and we're able to grow as a team now with Tatiana and Solomia, who have joined us. But just a reminder that we need your help to keep going. So thank you.
And if, again, you can check our other social media platforms or whatever you listen to podcasts, but special thanks and appreciation, again, goes to our Patreon sponsors. You know, don't forget that Patreon is also kind of a social media platform where we can communicate and keep in touch. And also our Patreon sponsors get a lot of extra stuff additionally for becoming sponsors. My favorite one is that all of you can join the live broadcast to ask our featured Ukrainians and Ukrainian allies your own questions, either in person or through us, through Tatiana, who helps you with that. But this is a privilege that is only reserved to our fantastic sponsors. Thank you so much for your solidarity and for believing in our mission. We only exist thanks to your help. So keep check every our platforms at ukrainianspaces.com. I think that's it, and I think we can safely to introduce our featured Ukrainian today. We decided to, I mean, we focus only on people and human stories first, with a bit of a focus that is additional in today's. The focus is legendary Ukrainian resilience, and Katerina will help us a bit with that as well. Katu, can you unmute yourself as well? And
sure.
Can you hear us?
Yeah. Yes, I hear you perfectly. Hello.
Hey. So our golden rule for every featured Ukrainian and Ukrainian ally, you please introduce yourself the way you would like for the rest of the world to know you, who you are, where you come from, and maybe a tiny bit about how your life has changed since the genocide started.
I'm Katerina Galitska, before the war, proud Ukrainian. That's usually the first I'm saying about myself right now. Before the war, me and my colleague, we ran the biggest production service company in Ukraine, also named the best service production company in the world in 2018. So we basically focus on, just to give a little bit of context, we usually shoot in, or used to shoot in Ukraine for foreign clients, basically from United States and from Britain as well. Right now I'm in Warsaw and I still work in a production and maybe that's it.
So I was just going to ask, Katya, if you could tell us a little bit. I know that you were, and if it's okay, feel free to share what you're comfortable with sharing, but I know that you were in Ukraine in the beginning of the full-scale invasion on the 24th of February. So I just wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit more about, you know, where you were, what you did, and how life, I mean, it's a simple question, but there is never a simple answer to it, but how life changed in that sort of first month or so for you with Russia's invasion.
Yeah. So for first, like, I would say that first of all, my life did change a lot even before the 24th of February, because as I was saying before, our clients are mainly from States and Britain, and like they depend a lot on insurance companies that insure production. So starting even December, when all those rumors about full-scale invasion like become more and more real, let's say, we didn't have any work because all our clients were saying that we are really sorry, we want to work with you, but our insurance company basically says that we cannot go and we will be charged with a manslaughter in case something happens to someone coming to Ukraine. And despite that, we had potential projects and we were bidding on a potential project even in February, but then we had to move everything we had to Poland. And so it was the first week for winter for many years that we almost had no projects, which is very unusual because we use shooting days a year. And so for, when the war started, I was in Kiev and I just, the only thing I did, I moved from my new apartment to my parents because they have a country house, and we always, like, there was kind of a plan every time we spoke about it with my parents, like, you have to, if something happens, you just come to our place because it's easier to survive where you have the fireplace and you do not depend much on electricity and so on. So my first, I moved back to my parents, which actually drastically changed my life. We live separately for more than 15 years right now. Also, and so, and we started, like, people who were in Poland already, because half of our production crew was already in Poland for some jobs. People started like raising money to help. It was actually on the first days, you didn't even know, like you didn't have a plan. What are you helping with? You're just like, okay, everywhere the help is needed, we're gonna go there and try to help, because we always say that basically producing is throwing money at problems. And but for me, I was trying to help with that as well, doing some PR, writing text, trying to coordinate it. But also I was doing what I can in Kyiv. I mentioned before, I drive electric cars. So the first weeks where there were some problems was gasoline for cars, I was able to drive around. So I was doing some basic help, delivering meds, delivering whatever. Like usually, like at some point, you just learn not to ask questions, what's in your trunk. Unless it's not moving and screaming, then it's fine. So yeah, that was my first 3 weeks in Kyiv, and I was very lucky because it was on the south of Kyiv, so it was very, very calm over there, and I was mainly, I just reading the news, and we didn't hear much, we didn't experience much, so I was very lucky with that. And also I was very lucky because it wasn't me who made a decision to leave Kyiv and Ukraine, because I didn't have this like plan at all. Some members of my family did leave in the first days, and they were basically saying, you have to go with us. And I refused because I didn't feel that it is the right thing for me to do. Because again, the way I am built, the way my work built me, I usually want to be in the middle of the situation just to help and try to solve the problem in any way possible. I'm not...
Yeah, which is also, I would tell, it's not just your work. This is very Ukrainian thing to do. And what you're telling us basically describes 99% of all experience of people, of all Ukrainians.
Yes, we are definitely not observers. And I was thinking a lot about this old Chinese proverb that if you sit on the riverbank, at some point river will, like, they're going to be the body of your enemy passing by. And I felt that that's definitely not about Ukrainians at all. That is like some, we're going to probably run, if we won't deal with our enemy ourselves, we won't wait until something happens to him. We're definitely going to find a way. So yeah, it's always like what I feel right now, especially being far away, is that actually there is some kind of serenity being in the situation. When you are really far, every problem actually is perceived like bigger than it is for real. And this beautiful October Mondays that we used to wake up to this terrible news, I was calling all my friends in Kyiv with this regular Yakti question. And everybody's like, oh, everything's fine. You know, we're in the bomb shelter celebrating my kid's birthday. We even have a cake. We're like, all is good. I'm walking my dog. And I was like, okay. So it's only me panicking. Good, good, good to know that. Thank you.
But I think it's, I mean, on the other hand, you're absolutely right for Ukrainians who are now abroad, whether refugees or those who live abroad. Of course, it's hard sometimes to grasp the reality of what is happening. And one, if you're not in the middle of a war zone, you will never understand fully that experience. On the other hand, you know, speaking to loved ones every day, you also understand how Ukrainians quickly normalize the horrors of the war, you know, being in bomb shelters, you know, living with a realization that you can be killed at any point, that your loved ones can die at any point. And that's a natural thing to do for a person, to try to normalize it. Otherwise, this is just unbearable to live that like that with that kind of realization. Is that true?
Yes, it is. And I totally agree with you. And I also feel that it is a very Ukrainian trait that if you can, like in every situation, you can either cry or laugh. And I feel that we Ukrainians, we always choose to laugh. And every time I'm talking to my friends, being like very scared of them, they actually laugh at me. And like, well, you know, like my friends right now, my close friend in Kiev, and like I speak to him almost every day, like, should I buy you a power, Jenny? Maybe like I found the school sleeping bags. Maybe I should buy two for you and your partner so you can survive winter in Kiev if anything happens. And he's like, well, you know what? It seems like you are more concerned with winter in Kiev than we are. Please stop. So yeah, they basically, and I feel that what is also very, very Ukrainian is try to find something bright and find some humor in every kind of situation. And yeah, and that is actually the best probably mechanism to survive through that.
You know what I was thinking, just to bring back to what Maxim and I mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast. It's like such a shame that Twitter had to, apologies for the language, go to shit when Ukrainians started joining it en masse and showing, you know, the way that we are and our humor and our sarcasm and our irony to the whole world. But yeah, I'm sure there'll be more of that. But so you're obviously from the creative industry, and Ukraine has been, as you were saying as well, quite prominent within the sphere that you're in as well. But I wanted to ask you, we've spoken a little bit about how your life has changed, but I was just wondering in general, how have, you know, Ukrainian creatives, Ukrainian creative industry adapted to essentially the war in Ukraine? And I don't know if you have any stories from people that you are able to share and tell us a little bit about, because I think it's really interesting to see how people's lives just, you know, completely changed in a space of a few months.
Yeah, well, so a lot of people obviously went to front lines, and people that you would never, like, again, we are from creative industry, so it is really, and you, like, I would say unusual, but I'm not sure if that's the right word. But I mean, like, a lot of people, even from creative side of filmmaking, DOPs, directors, actors, went to the front line. And that is something that I still cannot, like, bear with, just because I was helping my friend, very prominent Ukrainian DOP, Makita Kuzmenko. I was helping him to do a short spot for worldwide directors of photography a couple of months ago, and the only words that were in my mind all the time, because there was specifically about people like directors of photography and cameramen on the war, and I was like, the only words I kept telling myself is like, we all wanted to do a war movie, nobody thought it's gonna be a documentary. And that's what's happening, because a lot of, like, our casting director from Radioactive, he was in occupied village for 3 weeks with his wife and 2 kids. And he was able to get out, not because of the green corridor or whatever, just because of his casting skills and his abilities to speak to people, because he literally talked occupants and letting them out. And he, before the war, he was like a great aerial photographer. He had a book with aerial photos of Kiev, and now he is teaching guys to operate drones in Aerorozvedka. And that is, and I was actually, I had a huge conversation with him, and I was literally begging him to, because he showed me some videos from his work, and even there, be like with the composition and the way the picture is like built, you can tell that it's like his works, because he has a very distinctive style. And I was talking to him and begging him to do like make pictures if he can, because I feel it's going to be very important after our victory when we will have to, like when all the realization will come, and I think that we will have to process it through the art mainly.
Yeah, it's absolutely a devastating thought all the time, every day, because you know that this war is taking our finest to the front line. You know, we know so many of our friends, and luckily for the rest of the world, you can learn about them as well, because lots of those people are on social media and they tell the world what it's like on the front line. But those are not professional soldiers. They're directors, actors, you know, people from IT, like from all, absolutely all walks of life. And they volunteered and went to the war in the predominant majority by their own choice during the first days. And that's why sometimes you understand the impact as we keep losing more and more of those people on the front line, the impact that so many other parts of Ukrainian society will have for decades, because we're basically losing our best there. Absolutely. But Katerina, I wanted to, you know, also ask you a bit of your own perspective on living the life of a Ukrainian refugee. I know there's so much misconceptions, and part of it because of very direct, specific disinformation campaigns that we have so much evidence that they specifically target Ukrainian refugees and trying to portray them in a very unappealing light to decrease the solidarity for Ukraine. But nevertheless, like when you talk to anyone abroad, coming from your personal experience of now living life of Ukrainian refugee, what do you think people get wrong, or what would you like to convey the best, what it's like to be a Ukrainian person in that position these days?
Well, I'm not sure I will be like realistically there is so much going on that it is really hard to explain probably to anyone. I still cannot comprehend how normal life can continue anyway, like even in Warsaw, with everything happening at home. And I still, like, we were talking about this before. I feel that guilt is probably the main emotion that you feel like every day. And also it is like this common feeling that I'm not doing enough, where like no matter what I'm doing actually. But on the other hand, and that is also really, I feel important, and because yes, for example, living in Poland right now, being grateful for all the support and everything, sometimes people expect from you to grieve all the time, which is probably not the best way to do it. We all try to fight this postponed life syndrome and try to live our life as well, but sometimes you are actually expected to grieve all the time, which is very strange feeling, let's say. Also, I don't know, I'm sorry, that is like, that's a tough question for me, because that's like also a lot thinking that happening for me every day, how to explain to people, how to talk to other people. It's especially a little bit, I would say it's very tough in Poland, especially because you are being surrounded by people from Belarus, and people from Russia. And even like, and you don't know how to talk to them. And sometimes you have to talk to them because they are your neighbors or they serve you coffee. And it is like, and especially it's really hard because you don't know how to, like, they are trying to show a support or compassion. And you really don't know how to react to this.
Yeah. It's definitely something that many foreigners grasp, I think, to understand, like, that even being in the same space or with a Russian person could be traumatic for many Ukrainians, especially Ukrainian refugees. And that's not a matter of discrimination. To honor and respect the wishes of a Ukrainian person not to be in those spaces, and if possible, not to interact, at least until this genocide is over and we're watching it live, basically. And it's sometimes very hard to explain to other people who haven't lived through these experiences why this is uncomfortable and traumatic.
Yes, I had I had the experience, because what is really important in what I'm doing in Warsaw right now is trying to bring as much job to Ukraine, and we do a lot of documentaries. And in the, like, luckily it's not happening anymore, but I was asked to do a documentary where portray, for example, Ukrainian displaced children, and also get a perspective of a Russian kid living in Europe. And I was like, I cannot even explain what I felt at the moment. And I was, the only thing I was able to say is like, so you want to hire Ukrainians to listen how the Russian kid whines about him not being important anymore? I know that's not very professional of me, but that was the only response I got. And yeah, so what I would say about being a refugee living in Europe right now, and again, I'm very lucky, all my like apartment and work and everything were sorted for me, and I'm very lucky in this situation. But yeah, it's actually, it's not living, it's not life per se. It's like you feel, like I still feel being here for 7 months already. I feel that it is a very long business trip and it's gonna end any day and I will be able to go back home.
Of course you will. Absolutely. I actually wanted to, for folks who do not also know how huge the industry of film and production in Ukraine has been before the war, and basically being one of the largest centers in Europe for that kind of production. And your work and your company's work helped to bring up lots of stuff that then became kind of very reminiscent of Ukraine, or helped to promote Ukraine as this beautiful place where not only you can shoot, but you can go and travel and, you know, be. But then, Radioactive work, for example, on HBO's Chernobyl series, which I think several years ago was really an eye-opening piece for a lot of people about Ukrainian history, about, you know, Ukrainian history during the Soviet colonization and how that system basically produced one of the worst catastrophes in human history. But it was a very good moment, I remember, because a lot of people started thinking about Ukraine and seeing Ukraine in a different light, let's just say not in Russia-centric light, and hearing more Ukrainian stories, although that series was done by foreigners with the help of Ukrainians. But, you know, looking at that experience back then and looking at now, what Ukrainians are now in your industry are going to be able to tell, to produce stories and documentaries and everything else, do you think maybe it's a, we're looking at a potential unique moment where finally we can have bigger platform to tell our own stories the way we would like them to be told and for the world to listen at last?
Yes. Well, it is a little bit a tricky question because, you know, it always, like, it is right now, a lot of Ukrainian movies are being presented on the film festivals. And quite recently, Pamphyr movie, which was shot by Dmytro Sokolov-Kisobchuk and as a director, and Makita Kuzmenko as a DP. It was premiered in Cannes in this 2 weeks of director section. And it's also been just nominated for another award. I actually lost count for them. Also this year, The Vision of Butterfly, a movie actually about a girl who's returning from war, was premiered in Cannes as well. So a lot of movies are getting the recognition that they deserve. Also partly because of the situation at home and full-scale invasion. And I feel that we will finally be able to tell our story the way we want it. And but on the other hand, I'm really worried that I actually already was witnessing the situation where one director, foreign director, was like, well, I need a Ukrainian producer to apply for funding. I didn't need any like production help or whatever. I just need a Ukrainian surname on my application form. And I hope that it was like the only one occasion and that won't happen again. But yeah, this happens as well. And
you mean like tokenism and also probably brain drain? So because they don't want necessary for Ukrainian crews to film that, but to have a Ukrainian name so they can, you know, sell the project better because it's in. Right.
Yes. Well, I would say the brain drain as well. And actually, I would say that in our industry, all the production companies all over the world actually would love to have people from Ukraine working for them. And a lot actually do. For example, in Poland, we had this program as well in the beginning to try to employ our people who were abroad at the moment in foreign productions. And we had a lot of requests for people for our department, producers, production managers. And because everybody knows, and like we share the clients with all those companies, and they were like our direct competitors. So they all knew the level of our professionalism and the scope of work we usually do. And they were trying to get all those people to work for them was this like moment. Well, literally a couple of days before the war, I got an email. The small company from Latvia was saying, you know what, we just opened. And if you want to relocate all your company, we will be happy to accommodate. We will be happy to get you like residence cards and so on, so on, so on. But we are very lucky that the whole team wants to return back home and do what we love in a place we love.
Absolutely. I remember even the first day I tweeted something that went viral when millions of Ukrainians started coming as refugees to Europe, and I told, I don't know where I had this kind of conviction at that point. I told everyone that I bet 99.9% of all those people do not plan on staying. And they all plan to go back to our lives because, you know, whatever it is here in Europe, our lives are, we're so much, you know, for many, so much better back at home with actual careers, with actual lives, with prospects. And it's horrible that Russia is robbing once again our generation of these fantastic opportunities and our, you know, careers. But nevertheless, we will prevail. That's no questions about it.
I think we have enough time, I guess, for our last question. But before that, I wanted to bring in Tatiana, who's our audience engagement specialist, who has a question as well for you, Katya, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Katya.
Hey.
Okay, so first of all, I wanted to thank you for talking to us so openly and sharing your stories from recent months with us. It's been really helpful to so many listeners, I think, out here, just to kind of connect the people behind what they read in the headlines. I wanted to ask, actually, how, from your perspective, obviously you're creative, so you can kind of see things in a slightly maybe different way. And I'm wondering, how would you describe the resilience of Ukrainians, and where do you think that comes from? You know, from either your personal experience or kind of just kind of seeing how people manifest this kind of, it's an almost beautiful stubbornness that Ukrainians have. And, you know, is that something also that you always wanted to portray in a creative way? Do you think that's something that is number one for us as Ukrainians, that we are just so resilient?
Well, yeah, to be honest, we had this conversation with Valeria and Max before the start of the podcast, and I literally thought that's not a Ukrainian trait, but the industry trait, that we just, like, we are not built for defeat, and we keep fighting for a solution and keep fighting for a result in any way possible. But I do feel that, yes, it is not an that's actually what made us good an industry, not vice versa, let's say. But I feel that it's like we do not know where to stop, probably. Yeah. We keep banging the wall all the time. Like, okay, if we cannot do it this way, let's try this way and this way and this. And we just, like, keep trying. We just don't know how to stop.
Yeah.
That's probably it for me.
I like that you just said that, the bending the wall, because I think resilience comes with a lot of creative ingenuity. And I think that's what the world is seeing with Ukrainians.
Yes. It is true. It's like, and I was always saying, for example, that producing is solving problems in a creative way, but that actually can be applied not only to producing, it's also like can be applied to being Ukrainian.
Absolutely. It takes, I think it's perfect timing. And as a person who's also very often involved in production, I think, you know, that kind of, it's absolutely goes two ways. At the moment, I'm not sure what it comes from, my Ukrainianness, this desire to, like, just make shit work and make shit done, or it comes from the production side. But nevertheless,
you know, can I just add a little bit more? It's like being raised and kind of suppressed. Can I say it? Like, being raised as you are probably, like, not good enough, being raised with this thought all the time, our will to prove to other people, to outer world, that we are good enough. That was, I think that was also the source of us trying to just move forward in any way. Because for so many years, and I was born in the Soviet Union, and especially, like, for a long time, I thought, like, speaking Ukrainian is not good enough. Russian is, like, this very intellectual language, and speaking Ukrainian, it is, like, you are this not this, like, intellectual person, let's say. And a lot of stuff like that, like partying in Kiev, remember before 2013, protein in Kyiv wasn't cool enough compared to Moscow. So living was this feeling that you are not good enough and trying to prove that you are actually good enough, that you are at least on the same level. That is something that gave us this ability as well.
Wow, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for bringing up, and most of our Ukrainians all the time mention colonialism and how it shaped us into this inferiority complex when we always, thanks to Russia, but also partially thanks to West as well, we always think of us ourselves as less of people, you know, not good enough, as you rightly pointed out. And this is a powerful moment where we can finally reclaim, but also, you know, treated some of the reclaiming and finding strength to continue, just because we always were positioned and centered to do better, to do your utmost best, because you have to prove for the rest of the world much more than average person should. So yeah, I think it's a perfect actually bridge to our final and favorite question about Ukrainian identity. I think you've already touched upon it many times during these conversations and the conversation, but wanted to ask you nevertheless, what it means for you to be a Ukrainian these days, and has it changed in any way in the last 8 months, this kind of perspective for you personally?
It did change a lot. I was bilingual all my life. My mom is from south of east of Ukraine. My father is from Kyiv. My father's side of the family spoke Ukrainian. My mom spoke Russian. So I spoke, like, despite I went to Ukrainian school, and actually there was that Ukrainian school where you can be expelled from the school speaking Russian. I still spoke Russian even in school. So, and I did combine patriotism with speaking Russian. I have this unbearable anthem. Every time you hear our anthem, I stand up. It's just, no matter where I am, it can happen in a club, in a party, anywhere. I will stand up and listen to it while standing. Probably even sing, because that was also a tradition in my school. And again, I was speaking Russian all the time. I didn't understand at some point. I was working, before coming into production, I was working in a magazine as a journalist, and it was a Russian magazine. So when the owner said, we're gonna switch it to Ukrainian, I was surprised, and I was even kinda against. I was writing children books some time ago, and I did write them in Russian, and then do translation to Ukrainian myself as well. But I was sure that my Russian is better, and with my Russian, I can express more. So obviously when this all started, I actually didn't switch to Ukrainian straight away. I was like, okay, I can be Ukrainian patriot, but Russian speaking Ukrainian patriot. And then there was this rumor that Russia actually is gonna do this law that everybody who speaks Russian, they think of them as their sadichistiniki. Sorry, I don't know this word, like this classical Russian term in English.
I only have a very Soviet related word, like compatriots or something, to describe.
Yeah, that's like I was thinking about it, like comrades, yeah, something like that, very communistic term. So, and that was the moment where I switched to Ukrainian, because I was like, no guys, sorry, I don't want to have anything in common with you. My mom from Severodonetsk switched to Ukrainian as well, speaking to me, and right now I even switched my dog to Ukrainian, and it was a little bit of a process because he used to do all the commands in Russian. But I realized that walking on the streets, I don't want anyone hear me speaking Russian to my dog. So, and my brother, who lives in London at the moment, he also switched to Ukrainian because he said, like, I don't want to be perceived as one of them. So that was my step one in being Ukrainian. And my step two was coming through food, actually, because for a long time I was like, okay, if you are an intellectual, if you are a this like person from this creative industry, you have to like high cuisine, you have to like all this like French fancy restaurants where they paint these beautiful pictures on your plate with the food. And I was like, you know, actually, no. Actually, like, salad is amazing. And I want to eat vareniki all the time. And like, when it was a season, I'm lucky I'm in Poland. And I was like, the cuisine is very similar. And we have, I'm not a big cook at the moment, but we have our friends living here. And I do remember that my first time I was like calling my friend and I was like, can you cook golubtsy for me, please? And that was like, okay. And now I can tell everyone that like my favorite food is golubtsy. And I'm not ashamed of that, because before it was felt like, your favorite food is golubtsy? Are you from a village or what? And it was like kind of shameful. But now, no, definitely not.
Thank you so much. Very, very similar vibe, absolutely, in all of it. So it's kind of a therapy to listen to it and to understand how much we all connect with each other. And I see other Ukrainians actively on your live broadcast sending hearts and, you know, support reactions, because it speaks probably to 99% of us. Yeah, sorry, yeah. Lily, you have the question final.
Yeah. Oh, so, God, I think our main question is to finish off. We just wanted to ask you to share with our listeners, both who are here today live and those who are listening to us on the podcast in their time, what are some of your resources for people to follow and amplify? What are some of the projects you're working on to follow and amplify? Just, you know, your work and the work of your friends that those who are listening today can support.
Well, we do, at the moment, we try to do a lot of documentaries in Kyiv, and I'm very proud to tell that we did a production support on a recent David Letterman interview with Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv. I don't have a specific resource in mind at the moment. I would just say that the moment you have any kind of remote job possible, maybe it is good to think of hiring a Ukrainian for that, to do some research, to do translations, to do whatever can be done remote. Also, if you hear about any kind of social initiatives happening, like we just did, this Sunday, I was helping Makita Kuzmenko, Ukrainian DP, to do a short film about displaced children in Poland. And it was kind of both a dance video and a social video. And I think it's going to be very powerful. So I would say, if you hear anything of that, like, unfortunately, there are some chats on Telegram where people cooperate, but it's really hard to name just one resource, which is like, which gets all the information together, but it is that's it. If you hear if anything happening, just try to participate. You don't have to, or just make it loud.
Yeah, and amplify other Ukrainians. I just pinned the profile of Vladimir Demchenko, who is a very talented, brilliant Ukrainian director who is now on the front line, and he's regularly share stories from the front line, but it's a good example of all those best, most creative, most talented Ukrainians who are now forced to fight. So if you do love Ukrainian arts and you do love Ukrainian creative people, what they film, what they produce, what they paint, the music, anything, just make sure that you do your utmost best so this war is over and all those people can return back home from front lines, from refuge, and keep creating that famous, that legendary Ukrainian art that brings so much joy in all around the globe. So, yeah, thank you, Katya, дуже дякую. This has been very moving and nice, and thank you so much for sharing so much personal stuff as well. I think this is extremely important to amplify Ukrainian stories, especially these days during genocide. For everyone else, thanks for joining us live, but also if you're listening as a recording, as a podcast on podcast platforms, please spend a second, give it a rating and also a comment. It's extremely important. It helps us to keep trending on podcast platforms, and we're trending already, so good job with that, but help us to trend even better. And thanks a lot for Patreon sponsors as well. This couldn't been happening without you. If you're not our Patreon sponsor, please consider joining us. You can find all the information on ukrainianspaces.com, as well as all relevant links to latest episodes, to platforms, and also all our social media accounts are all also there. Thank you so much to Valeria, Titiana, Solomia for, you know, helping to bring this episode together. And I think that's it, apart from one final thing, which is Slava Ukraine.
Heroem Slava, and see you next time. Thank you, Katya.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.